Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
Chris Casso. And, of course, Mr. Cole Hornaday.
Hey, friends and neighbors.
How's everybody doing this fine evening?
Wonderful. Just peachy.
Just friends and neighbors.
Now is the dissension into madness.
Indeed.
It happens in
every third week.
Hey, everybody.
Speaking of friends and neighbors, it reminds me of this trailer I saw for a documentary about Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and I'm excited when it comes out. Have you all seen this?
Yeah, my husband and I both maybe cried a little bit.
Yeah.
Just at the trailer.
Just at the trailer.
Yeah.
I am with you.
Just at the trailer.
I'm going to have to watch that movie on my own.
Absolutely. And maybe with a scotch or two.
You know, we'd be sensitive guys together. We, you know.
He's
I watched
hugger,
you, Ben Lawrence. I watched you during Shape of Water. You were kind of getting a little bit sniffly.
I got touched.
Yeah.
I think it was the right person places? Kicking the seat behind me.
Yeah, it's true. You know, I have this theory that in the world of the next century that Fred Rogers will be sanctified. He will be a saint in some church of tomorrow.
He's already us heathen.
But I mean,
saints.
there will be stained glass windows
him
of Fred.
And Bob Ross.
Yes.
Saving squirrels and children alike.
You know, there will be this, you know, the statuary of this marble statuary of Fred Rogers. And I'm not really joking about this, folks. I'm not really.
No, I'm
looking
down.
More forward to that than the Scientology church going crazy in a couple centuries. And
that's right.
Think they survived to that point?
Oh, there's money. They have money. They will.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Swindling. Right.
Well,
this is awesome.
Moving on from a touchy-feely story like Mr. Fred Rogers to a down-and-out story. And as Cole takes a picture of the panel here, look for that on Cole's social media if you are so connected. But I saw this really self-indulgent article that I passed around to everybody from Fox2Detroit.com. And this interviewer wrote, he filed a story where he met William Messner Loebs, and who he calls Bill Messner Loebs, who's an artist who's worked on a lot of DC properties. He worked on the Max. He's a unique character because he only has one arm. He is missing his right arm, yet he says he lost his arm like when he was 13 months at a really young age, so where he was able to grow up and adapt having only one arm, and he became a bit of an artist and a writer, and he has not had a very good time. And I don't want to say recently, because he's not had a very good time for a long time.
Yeah. Ooh. It seems just like a lot of bad things tend to follow him. And at no fault at all. It's just that his luck just does not hold.
Yeah. Cole sent a story to us from comicbookresources.com where there was a Aardwolf Publishing and SilverBulletComicBooks.com are recording efforts to aid Bill following just the terrible things that happened to him. He, in 2001, his wife, both his wife and his mom,
and his
came down with some sort of illness. They don't specify which, and that was a financial burden. And then his house got foreclosed on, which happened to be on September 11th of 2001. Mm-hmm. And so he sort of took this attitude that whatever's happening to me is not a big deal in the grand scheme of things.
Right.
He's got this real, I wish I could think of the word, but he's...
You put it into perspective.
He did put it into perspective.
Empathy with other people.
Yeah. But since then, like, he's... when this reporter found him in, I think it was just this last month, in March of 2018, Bill and he and his wife were living out of a mobile home, but then they found a gas leak in the mobile home, so they had to leave it. And so now he's just been living out of his car, working as a janitor in a church. Mm-hmm. And just you read the story and you're like, what's going to happen next with this guy? Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about him. Let's talk about like what he's actually done. Like what comics, what properties has he worked on that we can check out?
What I always enjoyed the most was his writing on the Max. Mm-hmm. So that was created by Sam Keith, but Sam Keith is not a writer, and he knew he had to hire an established writer. So he had Bill Dewitt, and it's just one of my favorite comics that got turned into an animation at one point too. That was one of the more famous
MTV animated series. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There've been two action figures, two or three.
A couple, yeah.
He helped Sam Keith create this really cool world with the Izzes and the Mr. Gone, and this creepy reality that may or may not be real.
Mm-hmm. He also worked with Sam Keith on Epicurus the Sage.
Right.
I'm pretty sure that was him. Yep.
Yep.
And that's a really, really fun just comedy if you get the chance to read it.
I have those, and I haven't read them for decades, but those are kind of forgotten treasures right there.
Yeah, and I don't even
know. It was Piranha Press, wasn't it?
It was, I think so, and I don't even know if they're back in print.
You got it. Points for Cole.
he's much respected for his DC material. He did a good chunk of The Flash after like the crisis happened and Wally West became The Flash. So he was very instrumental in developing Wally West as the following in the legacy of Barry Allen.
And the reporter who we watched the video of and read the article of, he actually found those flashes in a box in his like mom's basement or something like that, and remembers his father reading it
because
to him
name,
when he was six. He was like, it was like
name kept ringing bells.
Exactly, but he like couldn't put it together, and then he found that, and he, you know, the guy was like, "Hey, you want an autograph?" And he was like getting almost a little misty, you know, like, "Yes, I would like that, please," you know.
And then he also created Artemis.
Artemis like from Wonder Woman.
Groundbreaking Wonder Woman characters, because didn't she replace Wonder Woman or Diana at one point?
Yep.
Yeah.
During when you either died or got your back broken, at least Wonder Woman
that
was
summer.
Just like, I'll just take a break. And
the summer of superhero mutilation.
And Artemis is part of the Red Hood comics right now, and she's probably going to be showing up maybe in one of the upcoming Wonder Woman movies.
Mm-hmm.
So,
he also had an out gay character, didn't he, in one of his comics?
The Pied Piper in The Flash. Yeah, so that helped kind of just develop the presence in superhero books.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if any of us here know this, but I'm guessing that he's not receiving too many residuals from characters he creates up here. Like, he doesn't get any money from DC when they use Artemis.
Probably not.
No, he gets his name on things.
Years ago, he probably did, when there was different people in charge of that, because they were never under any legal obligation to do it. But there was somebody at the offices that was just like, "But we're gonna do it." He's no longer there, so they try to save their money where they can.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, I don't think he got that. And I think in the article it said he doesn't really get any money out of the Max anymore, which I was surprised about since he didn't create the Max. But I'm guessing maybe he got some co-creator funds out of that. But the Max doesn't have a TV series anymore. It's been reprinted, but it's not a huge moneymaker.
Yeah.
So he's not going to have too many royalties coming in.
No.
He does do, sounds like some of the con circuit, because during some of this interviewing from the reporter, he was actually going to a convention to try to make some money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. He's since the article was written, there's been a bit of good news. Bill and his wife Nadine have been approved for a Housing Choice voucher, so he and his wife no longer have to live out of their car, and they're looking for a new place to live. Hopefully they'll be able to rescue a lot of their stuff from their condemned mobile home. It's just a sad story all around.
I think what struck me when I first back in 2005, when, because there was an article back then and they were doing some fundraising, I saw a lot of myself as an artist in that scary story, because, you know, artists don't have retirement, and artists don't, you know, they live pretty hand to mouth, and, you know, and that's what I was looking at and this has always been the truth, the story of most comic book creators who don't make it big, you know, and here's a gentleman who contributed a great deal to the evolution of numerous characters, made millions of people happy, and yet here is this reporter that says, here's this man, and look what's become of him. And it's not an unfamiliar story, but I also, I was projecting, and I still project myself onto this story because, you know, this is what, there's no backup plan for artists.
Yeah.
You don't have a retirement plan unless you, you know, have won the lottery with some character.
Not a lot of freelancers get to contribute to a 401k.
Nope. Yeah. Thank you.
You can resort to crime and then write a comic about yourself as a comic book writer. Writing superheroes, but you commit the crimes.
Published from prison. All right, so that's William Messner Loeb's. All the luck to him. Mark Hamill voiced a sentiment that I pretty much agree with, saying that Disney should pace themselves with the Star Wars release schedule.
Cap
I think
breaks.
This is this is coming on the heels of the Han Solo movie coming just 5 months after The Last Jedi. And I think he's right. I think Disney should slow down. I'm afraid that the Star Wars universe is going to be oversaturated, and what it's going to happen to it, what happened to, like, I don't want to say the early Batman movies, but like, because we're not going to get Joel Schumacher making a mockery of, you know, bat nipples, but
but I think that possibility is there.
Yeah.
You know, when you start talking about
Vader nipples.
You know, when you start Vader. Talking about creators that want to, and this is going to sound a little snotty, but want to deviate from the status quo of the storytelling that goes on in this universe.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the novels, the Star Wars novels, started to do some things. Like, there was a zombie, you know, there was a zombie stormtrooper story, and it's pretty much just like, you know, we're doing zombies on the Death Star. And it wasn't, and it was like not fan fiction. It was published through the Del Rey or whoever was.
Is it still considered canon?
Not anymore. No, none of that stuff.
They've wiped a lot of it. Yeah, and started rebuilding
it's all been
it.
Purged. Yeah. But I kind of saw that happening in the novels and the comic books. It's like, you know, I don't like the idea that one of my favorite universes, franchises, is getting diluted and becoming boring.
Yeah.
Because that's what's going to happen if you oversaturate. It's like people are going to get bored with, the magic is going to go away. The inspiration of how you tell these stories is going to become all crumbly and yucky.
Mm-hmm. They don't have any. Do they have anything slated for Christmas right now? I feel like they're doing an episode next year.
Yeah, it's too soon this Christmas for a new proper episode. And the plan was, from what I understand, a new Star Wars movie every year.
Yeah, that's what I had heard. So that's why I wondered why they were doing Han Solo.
And it feels like they're rushing it because I just saw, I mean, as we were recording this, it's early April. The movie is slated for May, and I just saw something not 2 weeks ago where, like, Ron Howard tweeted that they have picture lock on Solo. And I'm like, I don't work on that sort of level, but I would want picture lock on a movie more than a month and a half before release.
Mm-hmm. Well, remember, he also took over. So
yeah,
they're cobbling together the previously scrapped script and stuff like that. They threw out entire characters because they couldn't get actors back to reshoot.
Oh, those poor actors.
Yeah, no kidding.
I like to think that the studios are experiencing the same anxiety as the rest of us when they're like, we might not be around for another year. Those missiles might be flying. Let's get the money now.
I'm actually of the mindset now where I'm thinking about, well, what happens when we reach oversaturation with superhero movies, and I'm living in a reality where I'm foreseeing saturation of Star Wars, where, you know, this just boggles my brain. What comes next?
Ooh.
And I
a Western
saying,
resurgence.
That's what I keep saying, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah,
the Western is gonna come back with a vengeance.
Westworld's already here, so
yeah. Or better yet, the Westworld, a sci-fi Western type amalgam,
Mm-hmm.
stuff.
East and West has been optioned, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. All right. Well, yeah. Anyway, I agree with Mark Hamill. Slow the F down.
Tap the brakes.
Disney. Mm-hmm. All right. So here's a new story that I just added today. I haven't told you all, but I got it from your comic book rant, Comics Dungeon rant. Darkseid is joining the Justice League.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The Hannibal of the team.
Yeah. Scott Snyder laid out the parameters of his new take on the Justice League, beginning with May's Justice League No Justice miniseries, and those parameters include Darkseid, the evil god of Acropolis, joining the team. Joining the Justice League.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's I forget who was writing that one. Josh Williamson or
the No Justice stuff?
No, that's Snyder.
Yeah.
But they're splitting them up into three Justice titles.
There's Justice League Dark?
Yeah, so that's going to be Team.
Justice League Odyssey?
And that's the one with Darkseid.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And I forget who was writing it, but it's drawn by Stepshan Zizek. And so that'll look really nice.
Mm-hmm. Is that all? Is that all the Kirby characters?
It's got like Starfire.
When you call it Odyssey, I'm like, it's going to be all the new gods. And
So to answer your question, Chris, it's going to be written by Joshua Williamson.
Yeah, okay. Williamson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So why so many Justice Leagues?
Oversaturation
again. It's
slow the F down, yeah, DC.
It's the world we live in.
DC's like, we don't know how much time we got.
Time of oversaturation. It's terrible.
All right. Anyway, I just saw that today, so I thought it included anything. Anything? Do we want to see Darkseid with the Justice League? Do we care?
Is it
a big deal?
Depends on just how they do that. I'm looking forward to the art in it, so I know it's going to be pretty at least.
Yeah.
Darkseid's been a little overused and weirdly used for the past 2 or 3 years. And so if they can give us something better than that, I'll be happy. The idea that he's basically like Hannibal on the team, where he's just like the serial killer that they know is there, but they got to have him around for the ride for whatever reason. Oh, it is going to be kind of new god stuff because the source wall blew up. And so they need to like get past the source wall and do stuff. And so Darkseid's the one. But like Darkseid's been a baby for the last year. Like he got reverted into baby and then he just got like reborn and now he's fighting Wonder Woman.
So has he been reborn as a kinder, gentler Darkseid?
No.
You know,
murder
he
murder baby.
So murder baby. There's Justice League Odyssey, which Darkseid is in, and Justice League Dark, which I can't believe Darkseid isn't in Justice League Dark.
Yeah, it seems like a no-brainer, doesn't
They're reusing
it?
The name of the Magic Justice League, and so they just wanted to keep it with the magic stuff.
Justice League Dark's been around for 10-plus years.
Since New 52 launched, which makes me sad. They make it sound like we're going back to doing this classic thing, and it's just like New 52's not that... Oh, it is getting old. Oh, no.
Yeah, it's like 7 years old now.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I just want to say Justice League Darkseid. Anyway, so that's that. Let's talk about comics that influenced us, friends. We all here, most of us have been reading comics since we were a wee babe. Let's talk about comics that left a lasting impression. What left you thinking about it for some time, maybe years afterwards? Did you read it again? Now, for you, it's Preacher, because I know you reread Preacher every year.
Yeah. So Preacher had a lasting effect on me. There's a lot of like little mini effects. Like I remember when I was really young reading Spider-Man, because he was my guy when I was, about 10 to 13. And they did Maximum Carnage, which is not a great story. But Carnage went around the city murdering people like nonstop for like 13 issues. And I remember like really not liking casual murder as a concept. And I really dislike it in all sorts. Like, I'm okay with like violence and death and mass murder in stories when it serves its purposes. But when there's like just casual murder where everybody becomes faceless and it's very gratuitous, that's where I'm just like, I really don't care for this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I got from that storytelling. So that left like an early impression that way. Because it made me like really question death at the time. And because you just had a lot of like really vicious killing going on for 13 issues in a mainstream superhero book. And not all of it was really on panel, but you got the impression of how bad things were. So that's like an early impression for me.
Yeah. Anybody else?
Yeah, I mean, I got tons of stuff. But
what do you got?
Do it.
I know I've mentioned this before. I'll mention it again, though. Johnny the Homicidal Maniac made an impression on me, and I think it was because I'm such a dark soul, and but I also like sarcasm and satire and things like that. And so it spoke to me at a time. I pretty much everything on my list I would like to reread because there's things that, and that's why I'm doing things like Preacher, because there's things that I know were pivotal for me, but I don't know if they still hold. Mm-hmm. And I have Johnny at Home, but I haven't reread it. So I want to know if it would still hold true for me now. I am still a dark soul, but I don't know if I'd be in that same place that it would hit the same way, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things where it's like watching old movies or TV shows from when you were a kid that you really liked, watching them again as an adult, and like, oh, this isn't very good.
Yeah, like She-Ra is like really boring. It's really sad. But Jem's kind of entertaining.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another one that I wanted to mention was Zero Girl. That's one by Sam Keith. Mm-hmm. And that was a two-volume series, and that hit me kind of in my early 20s, and it was something that showed me like a different stylized artwork. I liked Fringe comics, obviously, and it spoke to me, but almost in the like romantic side of me, which definitely was not tapped into in my early 20s. So there was something to that, and that's another one. It's got such weird elements, but it also has this like true love kind of story. But then squares are fighting circles, and there's puddle girls, and like it's weird stuff. So it is back in print now, and that was something on my radar again because a spooky kid gave it to me and was like, "You would like this," and he was right.
Cool. Do you got anything?
Yeah, I one of the first comic books I discovered as a little boy was Mike Grell's Warlord, and it was the perfect pulp. Looking back, it was the perfect pulp comic book. It was this Travis Morgan is this Air Force pilot trying to spy on Russian germ warfare sites near the North Pole. And he gets shot down by missiles. And when he awakens, he's in a tropical jungle where there are dinosaurs and robots and spaceships. And it was just like this. And beautifully rendered by Mike Grell, and it's just was this pulp, and I didn't know anything about Conan. I didn't know anything about pulp traditions. It just sparked my little boy imagination all up and down my spine, and it was the only comic book that I ever read with my dad. My dad flipped through one, and he really thought that was great. So he would actually come into my bedroom and ask me, you know, do you have a new Warlord? He'd sit there, and I had a director's chair in my basement bedroom, and he'd sit there and flip through them and read them, and then, you know. But my dad and I would never, you know, I didn't like sports as a kid, so I didn't throw around football with him. But, you know, I liked the idea of having a Warlord comic book because Dad would come down and read it with me.
Didn't he like ElfQuest too a little bit?
He did. Yeah, good memory. Yeah, he did like ElfQuest.
What is it with a fairy book or something?
Pixie book.
The Pixie book.
The Pixie book. Yeah.
You got that Pixie book?
Yeah. Any more than Pixie books? Yeah, he liked that stuff. As Chris can attest to, I actually went back through my old battered Warlords, and I'm like, you know, this stuff is not hold up well at all. The stories are terrible and sexist. And actually, Grell's artwork is not as great as I remember it being. But gosh darn it, I'm going to replace all of my battered copies from childhood with nice, squeaky clean, new, pristine ones. And so I did. And Chris actually, you had someone bring in like a whole stack of them, right? They were
a while ago.
Darn near mint condition, and I went and bought them all.
Because nostalgia.
Because nostalgia. Yeah.
Absolutely. And,
but I had really beat the ever-living crap out of those comic books.
Well I'd loved. Read them.
Yeah, they were all. And of course, Dad helped too. He always smudged my comics.
I totally get the nostalgia. That's why I still collect baseball cards from the era when I collected baseball cards, because that visceral thing of like sitting on my bed and opening up a pack of 1989 Donruss. This is very specific, a 1989 Donruss, and finding a Ken Griffey Jr. card, because in 1989 that was the card to have, because he was a rookie with the Mariners, and he, like, in this area at least, he was very like, you need to have that card. And so I will still buy boxes of these baseball cards because you only have to pay for the cost of shipping, and just sit on my bed and open up these packs. And if I get a Ken Griffey Jr., I'm like, it's so great. Even though the card's worth like 50 cents, you know.
That's matter. Awesome.
Almost nothing.
I love it.
But yeah. So any final impressions of comics from the panel here?
It's not specific comics, but when I started exploring with European comics like the Incal and the Metabarons, and then when I started exploring more with manga, each of them opened tons of new doorways as far as potential storytelling techniques, yeah, and types of stories. And
I feel like we've been with you on your manga journey.
Yes.
Well, I mean, it's a revisitation.
This is a revisitation. My manga journey started way back at like 14, 15. So yeah, that stuff had its own impact and opened different doors. So
yeah, cool. For me, I think, you know, I eventually discovered X-Men, and it was Chris Claremont, John Byrne, X-Men stuff, and that got me. And I don't think I was actually cared about superheroes until I read those X-Men comic books, and then Star Wars comic. But I think the next big impact on me was Dark Horse started putting out very limited amount of black and white comics, and they were printed out of Portland, and I grew up in Oregon, and that was and those early black and white comics out of it was just when I started college, Black Cross and Boris the Bear and Concrete and The American and all of these books that were actually really challenging the status quo of storytelling. And but black and white comics, that was like for underground and drug comics. And they were actually printed on pretty crummy paper too for the time. But I have very fond memories of going to one of my first comic book shows in Portland, and the Dark Horse publishing company was there, and picking up these early copies of these books and Dark Horse Presents, and just being so excited about the possibility of independent comics.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah.
Nicole, any final thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, I've mentioned a bunch of stuff that has impacted me on the podcast. A Silent Voice is one of them. That's a manga that is so beautiful that I almost cried on this podcast. And then Batwoman Elegy, you know, that still holds very true for me. Having this super stylized Batman family story showed me that superheroes can look look a different way. You know, you can have a queer protagonist. You can have this really interesting story that's not your standard fare. And it really made an impact on me and made me think, like, maybe I could look at some more action superhero comics.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Cool. Mm-hmm. All righty. Thank you all. Let's move on to Book Report. And Chris Cassell, let's start with you.
So I've been bad and not catching up or tackling things that are too big. And I have like a book that I made it like 1/4 of the way through. And then a book I made it through 3/4 of the way through. So I'll do
it. Oh, you read a total book.
Yes, there you go. And surprise, they're both manga. But so the one that I mostly finished with, and it's a bunch of short stories, so I'm finished with a lot of little stories, is Junji Ito's Shiver, which is a series of reprints of selected short stories that he selected himself. Yes.
I'm sorry, sidebar, buddy, but I bought this book on your recommendation, and you tell me that you never actually read this
it's
book?
It's Junji Ito. Come on.
You're sassy.
Yes.
What, do you want to return it now?
Yeah. Noelle, I'm kind of, I'm having an internal debate.
No, I've read bits and pieces of him.
Okay.
And
fair enough.
Yes.
Yeah. And
this is all older stories.
Because I got excited about reading this stuff because we were talking about body horror.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Okay. I'm done interrupting you. Please continue. Okay.
So
I won't interrupt you anymore. Please feel free to keep talking.
Yes. Carry on.
So if you're not familiar with Junji Ito, there's actually a very interesting review of his work online that basically says that he's one of the most read comic authors in the world, just nobody knows who the heck he is because he's become a viral meme. A lot of his stories are just so weird and they're so short that they get shared for free online and pirated around. So a lot of people know about like the weird story that's like the Uzumaki is like the town that's haunted by spirals.
Yeah.
And Gyo is the one about zombie fish. And there's the really famous one about the mountain range that cracks open and there's human-shaped holes in it. And people like have dreams and go to the holes and they're like, that's my hole. And so he's very well known. So this has a bunch of short stories. Some of them hit better than others. And I'll mention two of the best ones for me. There's the one called Hanging Blimp, which follows a young schoolgirl pop star who is found hanging from a building, and everybody thinks she committed suicide. And then people start seeing her ghost, but it's like a giant blimp size version of her head. And at first people are like, oh, this is just people mourning and mass delusions. But then there's photos and people are like, no, this is a real thing. And then her boyfriend like finds her head floating at the park, and then he tries to go and like touch it, and he falls and is hanging by, and there's another blimp that has his face and a noose, and it's hanging him. And so all these heads start showing up in the sky over Japan, and they all have a noose, and there's a head for every person in the city, and it's they're trying to find you specifically and trying to kill you.
Ooh.
And that's it. Like, wow. The way all his stories are like, here's a thing that's really weird. I'm not going to explain it. Goodbye, we're done. Every like book like, is like that. Yeah, there's...
Which is also unsettling, right? Yep. Because you just don't necessarily get any resolve. It's just left there.
They're all dream logic, but they also have the tone of, like, old EC horror stories. And because there's the one about... this family are all puppeteers, and like the youngest son really kind of hates the life because they move around to town to town, and his older his father dies, and the older brother just kind of leaves and takes like the most famous puppet with him. And years later, the older brother sends a letter to his younger brother and tells him like, hey, come visit me and my family. And when the younger brother goes into the house, everybody is floating on strings, and there's panels above every room in the house where there's puppeteers. And the older brother's just like, yeah, I found a new way to do my art, and I never have to lift a muscle again because everybody's doing it for me. And it gets weirder from there.
It's very Tales of the Cryptian to me.
So they're really good. They're really quick bits and pieces. The hardcover is $22.99. It also features Zit Horror.
Zit Horror?
Is that what I think it is?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And
cystic horror tale.
Yeah, yeah. And but there's a lot of body horror, and there's a lot of Lovecraftian tones to this, and it's very interesting seeing it come from different cultural perspectives. And you get little lessons at the end of each one where he's like, here's some sketches, and I got this from this third dream I had, and yeah, I just felt like creeping you out, you know, stuff like that. So Junji Ito's Shiver, I recommend all his works. They're just weird.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Cool. All righty. Thank you, Chris. Nicole, what do you got for us?
So there's an import, thanks to Lion Forge. We've talked about Lion Forge before. And Magnetic Press, who... do you know if Magnetic Press is an American company that's kind of like a Humanoids?
I thought they were, and they got bought out by Lion Forge.
Oh, okay, so they're one and the same now.
Yeah, they're
okay,
one the same.
I thought they were working together. Yeah, Lion Forge is just a like amiibo pseudopodding, like all kinds of stuff.
I gotta go back to biology to understand that reference.
I like pseudopods. That's just how they eat. It's the little fingies. Anyway, so Infinity 8 is what I'm reviewing today. Number one, it's going to be a long-running sci-fi tale. And it follows this one woman who is, I don't know if I'd say a soldier, maybe kind of like a secret agent sort of type.
Slash cop,
she's that sort of person. Very vivacious and sexy and voluptuous, and she's walking through this space station, and there's just tons of different alien type people that she comes across. Like, I kind of thought Fifth Element, of like all the different weird creatures you see, and humans
and fashion.
Yeah, and she's a human, and as you go through the beginning of it, she's trying to find like a good genetic mate so that she can procreate. So she's like scanning all these people as she's going, and different aliens, and being like, nope.
You've got asthma. You've got
You're an alcoholic. Nope. And she like zaps people and different things like that. So she gets this mission from this alien creature that can live through 8 different timelines. There's this space debris that's gotten in the way of them moving forward. and she needs to go out and figure out like what's going on there and like how they can make it through. And it's called Infinity 8 because there's going to be 8 different timelines that you're going to read the comic throughout with different arcs throughout. So this first arc is going to be, I think, 3 issues, and they're also going to change up the artists as well.
Wow.
So I like that premise. I think it's really interesting. She goes out, and then she finds all sorts of wacky things. I don't want to quite like talk too much more about it because I really enjoyed the experience of it. There's the art is in this arc is by Dominique Bertheil. It's written by
Lewis Trondheim
and Zepp.
Yes.
Zepp.
So I think it's Lewis throughout writing it, and then we're going to get different mix-ups of artists as the arcs go on. And even in the back, it tells you all the different breakdowns of all of that. Like, welcome to your epic journey. Welcome aboard the Infinity 8. And so it's just really like pulpy, fun, sci-fi adventure. I loved the world. I just pored over the art and the pages and all these little bits and details and different elements that they put within it. So I'm like all aboard on this thing. Let's see here. Yeah, there's just a whole list of different artists. It's a really long list of different people who are going to be involved in it. So it's a really cool title. I had somebody visiting from France, and he's like, oh, yeah, we're already at issue 8. And I'm like, dang, you imports. So we haven't even gotten an issue 2. Maybe we will by the time that this is out. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you want to add? Because you've read this.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. Lewis Trondheim is well known for a lot of things, but he did the Dungeon series, which I think NBM translated and brought over.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got a quirky sense of humor
mm-hmm.
and a good range. And so I do like him a lot.
Yes, it is a mature title. There is nudity in it. Mm-hmm. But if you are into that sort of pulpy European sci-fi, sort of like heavy metal, you know, kind of stuff, I would definitely recommend it.
Cool. Infinity 8. Thanks, Nicole. Mm-hmm. And finally, Mr. Cole Hornaday, what do you got for us?
Well, in my quest to read all of the recent Black Panther reprint collections available through Seattle Public Library, I read Panther's Quest.
On your quest. You went to Panther's Quest.
See what I did there?
Yeah, yes. I see what you did
Have
there.
You read this one?
No, it's on my long list
okay,
of things.
Okay, all right, yeah. I'm really glad I read it because I missed the opportunity to read the whole series back in the day. And Panther's Quest is written by the classic Black Panther writer Don McGregor and was illustrated by Gene Colan. And it was originally published in as a part of a 25-issue serial in Marvel Comics Presents in 1988. And Marvel Comics Presents would probably have been forgotten if not for it being the first opportunity we had to learn the real hardcore origin of Wolverine with the Weapon X story by Barry Windsor Smith. The thing about Marvel Comics Presents is that it was a nightmare to keep up with because it was weekly. And I actually gave, after I got done reading the Weapon X story, I'm done. Because I couldn't afford to pay, I mean, heaven forfend, it was $1.50
every week.
It was $1.50. Well, remember, I was also reading like a boatload of comics, but like I kept putting off reading it and putting off reading it. And I go to my box at the store and in Eugene, and there would be a stack of Marvel Comics Presents. So I never finished reading Panther's Quest, and I'm really, really glad I got an opportunity to read it now. This is not the Black Panther we know now. Basically, the story is that T'Challa has learned that his mother, Renanda, remember her name?
Ramonda, thank you. I was like, you're close.
did not die. She was actually abducted and spirited away to by a wealthy. We don't learn. I'm sorry. Some spoilers. But she's been held. But she's been
in
held
South
captive
Africa, right?
In South Africa during the apartheid regime.
Mm-hmm.
And he learns of this and sneaks into South Africa to rescue her. And this is a, you know, the Black Panther we know now is a very high-tech character, especially in the movies. The Afrofuturism, one of the fascinating things about it is all of this wealth of high technology at his fingertips that he can utilize. This is a low-tech Black Panther story where, he flies, he sneaks into South Africa in a sonar jet and hides, but he is an incredibly vulnerable character as he traverses this broken landscape of South Africa and all the messed up politics and the slave culture. The sickness of the culture at that time is repeatedly played out on T'Challa's body. He is lacerated by razor wire. He is burnt with gasoline. He is slashed open with a tin roofing. He is shot. He's continually mutilated through this whole story. And it's kind of hard not to miss that McGregor is using this as a metaphor for the mutilation of Black bodies and Black culture in South Africa. And Gene Colon's artwork is kind of been forgotten. He was not a particularly diverse illustrator, and his storytelling and his illustration style didn't always work for everything. I mean, he drew Tomb of Dracula at the same time he was drawing Howard the Duck, and it didn't always work, but he was a skilled artist. And the thing that always struck me about his artwork is everybody looks like they're made of fog. You know?
Yeah,
they do. Everybody looks
slightly ethereal.
Yeah, everybody does, and they always have. There are no hard angles to his illustrations, and frankly, it's perfect for this story. And McGregor's text, and this is back in the day when some people were writing comic books, they were writing you a novel, and there just happened to be pictures.
Yep. Yep.
And this is a dense story, and it was told in 25 installments through the course of Marvel Comics Presents. This is a really terrific story. It's a really terrific metaphorical take on, and it's an introduction to what this culture was like, and to have a superhero go in and barely survive the experience mm-hmm. of being a Black person in this reality. I highly recommend this. I think it's probably one of the best Black Panther books I've read. I'm sorry I didn't read it back in the day.
All right, cool. Panther's Quest. Thank you, Cole.
Good stuff.
Well, that is Book Report, and that is our show. And coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com. And Comics Dungeon here, 319 Northeast 45th Street, in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes or however you get your podcasts at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. And now, friends, get your quiz hats on as quiz time. And this week, our questions come to us from Mr. Chris Casso. Lay it on us, Chris.
So I was having trouble figuring out what I wanted to do, and then Nicole confirmed for me that in the new Pacific Rim movie, a bunch of the kaiju merged together. And
it's a combiner kaiju.
Yeah. So this podcast is dedicated to combiners of all shapes and forms, and it is called All for One and One for All, or Oi Gestalt.
So,
question number one. Composed of 6 Decepticons who could transform into various construction vehicles, this combiner, or Gestalt entity, is the first of its kind in the Transformers cartoons and comics. Who is this?
It's a Constructicon, but I don't remember his name. What's his name?
I
don't know Transformers. The very first one. He's green.
Yeah.
I had the dump truck.
I can't.
Just Devastator.
There we go.
I knew it started with a D.
And I knew it was like an or, like a...
I had a follow-up for extra points. Name two others.
Victorion.
Yeah, hey, you
and,
got that.
And... Yeah. I don't know. There was one that's like a city that's like a dino that like adopts little guys.
But he doesn't merge, so.
Oh, he's not a merger?
No.
Oh, okay. He's just a big guy.
That's okay. I would have accepted Predaking.
I should have gotten that one. Isn't that the guy I want?
That's the guy you want.
No!
Yeah. Okay.
He's so chunky.
Yep. So, next question. Originally called Beast King Go Lion in Japan, this American animated television series featured a team of astronauts who pilot a giant super robot as they defend the universe from the evil King Zarkon from the planet Doom. What was the series called?
To Voltron?
Yes.
Voltron.
What's the full title?
I don't know. That was a good guess.
Voltron, Defender of the Universe.
Oh, okay.
And I'll say
that, Mr. Smarty Smarty Pants.
And I'll say that the new series from Netflix is fantastic.
Really?
Yes.
Is it animated computer?
It's animated, but the lion parts are CG and it works. My lion parts are CG.
I had a friend who had all of the Voltron toys, nice. And that was a big get when you were a kid.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a lot of diecast.
Yeah.
Okay, next. Originally derived from footage from the Japanese series Super Sentai, the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers followed five teenagers who were selected by an alien being called Zordon to fight his eternal enemy, Rita Repulsa. Zordon gave each teenager a powerful mecha shaped like a dinosaur, or what's called Zords. A little vanity there. Over the years, there have been many iterations, including Ninja Zords, Thunder Zords, Shogun Zords, Zeo Zords, Turbo Zords, Galacta Zords, and so on.
What's
the name of the type of Zords popular in the 1993 American relaunch, and what was the name of the merged Gestalt form? What did I say they were?
Zords.
No, but what? There was another defining word there.
Zoron.
Dinosaurs. So
yeah. Dinosaur.
Dinosaurs.
And the merge version was called Megazord, or the Dino Megazord.
Okay, that's familiar now.
This is Mighty Morphin Power
Rangers. I watched Mighty Morphin Power Rangers like one summer when I was 9. Yeah.
Fusion is the process of merging two or more separate beings into one, combining their attributes from strength and speed to reflexes, intelligence, and wisdom. When properly fused, the single being created has an astounding level of power. And so Dragon Ball Z and Steven Universe both have many characters that can unite and fuse to form composite characters through dancing together or coming together in some form of harmony. The other thing both of these properties have in common are funny portmanteau name mashups. I'm going to name a couple pairs. You try to guess the merch name.
Oh, man.
Goku and Vegeta.
Gogeta?
Is one of them, or Viku, or Fat Gogeta. Because apparently when you screw it up, you just get Gadumpy.
Gadumpy?
Next is Krillin and Piccolo.
Crickolo.
Krillin and Piccolo.
Krillin and Piccolo. Piccolo is the green guy.
Yeah, I love Piccolo.
Krillin.
Oh, Krillin. Krillin. That's pretty
good. And Steven and Connie.
Oh.
Stani.
I can't remember.
And I've seen that one too.
Yeah, I've seen it too.
I've never seen any
Stevani.
Of these.
Stevani.
Stevani.
Last question. Created in 1978 by Jerry Conway and Al Milgrom, Firestorm was distinguished by his integrated dual identity. A high school student and Nobel Prize-winning physicist were caught in an accident that allowed them to fuse into the nuclear man Firestorm. Firestorm has the ability to rearrange molecular and particle structure of any substance into most anything, changing the subatomic particles of matter and energy to create objects comprising different atomic characteristics of equal mass. Over time, other people would merge into the Firestorm matrix. Name at least three different people who have comprised Firestorm. There's a long list.
Can I phone a Scott?
Wow.
Well, wasn't Ronnie Raymond?
Yep,
the first.
That's one.
And I can't remember the professor's name.
He is a professor. I'll let that go.
So you got two. You need one more.
Martin Stein is the professor.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep. I will also allow TV show stand-ins. Or Russians.
Wait, TV show stand-ins. So wait, what TV show?
He's in The Flash and in the DC.
Oh, I see.
Heroes of whatever.
Tomorrow.
The Heroes of Tomorrow? Is that what it's called?
They made up somebody for that one.
Yeah. Okay.
I would have accepted Jason Rush, who was the black college student that is also on the TV show. Mikhail Akadin, Gehenna, Deathstorm, or Jax Jackson.
Ooh,
or the entire Justice League at some point.
Jax Jackson.
Once you go Firestorm, you don't come back.
All right, well, that's great. Thank you, Chris. And thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.